Well, our guest now says chief executives and senior managers have a legal duty to protect the mental well-being of workers and eliminate toxic work environments. Dr. Hilary Bennett is a registered psychologist specialising in the leadership of safety and well-being. She's been consulting for decades here and overseas in the private and public sectors. She recently authored a guide for the Business Leaders Health and Safety Forum on protecting mental well-being at work. Forum members are chief executives, managing directors and other senior leaders of most large organisations in the country. Dr. Bennett says a range of surveys suggest mental harm is increasing due to modern work practices, and while many organisations offer well-being programs, such as free fruit on Fridays, if it's the workplace that's harming an individual, it's up to the leaders to fix that, not to try to fix the individual. Hilary Bennett is in the Auckland studio. Morena, welcome.
Good morning, Catherine.
Typically, what constitutes a toxic work environment? What will be happening?
In a toxic work environment, there will be a range of what we often refer to as psychosocial risks, but refer to them just as risks to well-being. And they will be, difficult or destructive work relations. There will be workloads that are untenable. There will be a pace of work that people can't keep up to. The work will spill over so that people's home life balances are just out of sync, and many other factors. The key thing here, Catherine, though, is that it's not a particular set of risk factors. Workplaces are so varied, and what we don't often think of is the variety of things that could be impacting on people's well-being that make it toxic. We tend to go to the classic ones like bullying and harassment, which obviously we know are key issues, but I suppose the call we're making is to actually realise that there's a much wider range of factors that can actually impact on people's well-being and therefore be toxic.
What are some of the others that are underestimated or under-discussed?
To be honest, I think the key one that I see wherever I go is the interplay between the number of staff people have in the organisations relative to the workload. People work extremely long hours, and of course, COVID with many people working at home has created an additional complexity there, because now people are working in homes have become workplaces. So I often see the key issue being a staffing and workload issue. But, you know, in and of that, there's whole things like unclear expectations, politics in the office, being undervalued, lack of appreciation for the work people are doing. It really is a broad range of factors.
Where is the responsibility or the ability to change this? You send down the challenge right at the chief executive level, but in many organisations, where do you often see this not being managed? Is it middle management, line management? Yes, the CEO ultimately is going to set the culture and give permission for change or insist on change, but where do we often see these manifesting and not being dealt with?
Well, I think what we see is that the responsibility for creating a workplace where people aren't harmed, either physically or mentally, obviously sits with the senior leadership team. But the responsibility to implement workplace well-being programs often goes down to your more operational level. And that is one of the issues that we are trying to address in terms of this forum guide, is to say to leaders, the reality is we need to stop just trying to toughen up our people. We need to stop having a very individual, symptom-focused approach to well-being, resiliency program, psychological first aid. Not that in and of itself those things aren't valuable. But if we are going to be serious and have a long-term impact on this, we have to look at the work rather than the individual. And the decisions that relate to work being redesigned will often be quite complex and long-term, and those decisions are made by senior leaders. So that's why I strongly argue that this work is the work of the executive, because if they don't understand the importance of actually taking a hard look at the way the work is managed, it's organised, and it's designed, we're probably not going to have the long-term impacts that we need to see.
So you're saying your yoga's one thing, your quiet room's one thing, your free fruit and your mufti day on Friday is one thing, but actually that is just, it's actually some of it is just one could be cynical and call it tick boxing, compared to box ticking, rather than getting to the heart of the issue, which is that there is too much pressure on your staff and possibly on their managers. If you are coming to look at changing the way work happens, though, is this another issue that, again, that often gets decided not by those experiencing the stresses, but by people further up? And is there a challenge with having the guts, frankly, to come right down to whatever the worker level is, individual teams' levels, and say, what's happening? Where are the friction points? And be informed in any changes you're making.
Oh, absolutely. So if the issue here, Catherine, is that these psychosocial risks or risks to well-being are quite different to physical risks. You know, if we said a workplace was noisy, we'd all agree that that was going to impact on people's hearing. We'd be able to measure it. We'd go and put some controls in to measure it. And we'd all be pretty much on the same page. But when we come to trying to understand these risks to well-being, they're a different beast. They're much more subjective, much more personal. You know, what a person at the top of an organization might see as an acceptable workload might be quite different. And it's not a matter of right or wrong. It's just that they're different. They're very personal. And so if we are really going to design work to meet what we would see the criteria of good work, we have to go down to talk to the people that are actually doing the work. And that's one of the process that we're suggesting, is that you go to like-minded, naturally occurring work groups, people doing the same work, and you have facilitate conversation with them to say, what are the things that put your well-being to risk? We can't have health and safety managers going in and deciding what those risks might look like. They have to talk to the people.
But that comes back to culture, because how honestly do you believe some people will answer surveys or answer inquiries if they believe they're identifiable? Everybody's, and this is the problem in organisations, everybody's in the business of protecting their position.
Yeah. So that's right, and there's a fear there from many people around the senior leadership tables of, you know, what they might hear and what that might mean in order for them to do difference. But the bottom line, I think, is this is where there needs to be a fundamental shift. If I can go back to your point earlier on around, you know, the fruit on the Monday and the yogas. I mean, I know that sounds a little bit cynical, but the reality is those programs are put in with all the best intentions of the world. But the problem is that they haven't taken a considered approach to actually looking at well-being. So if we don't go back and actually say what might be the factors that either risk people's well-being or actually also protect their well-being and do a considered piece of work. So to go back to your next point in terms of whether that's, Is there a culture of psychological safety? Is there a culture of trust? Because that's really what it requires. Is fundamentally key. But I don't think we can say, well, we won't start doing this work because there isn't a level of trust. I think that what I'm hearing from businesses is a real desire to do this protection of people's well-being in a more considered way.
Well, they're hurting, aren't they? Because the absenteeism. And I mean, there are some shocking statistics coming through. This workplace barometer that found 70% of respondents reported an absence from work during the last 12 months. This was 2020, due to physical and mental health issues. So there is a real cost to business.
Oh, yeah, there is a very huge cost. I mean, the other figure that people often will put in the mix is that, you know, 1 in 4 New Zealanders, and that's not that different to if we said 1 in 4 Australians, or is in your workplace at any point in time, will be experiencing a mental health challenge. Now, I'm not saying that they will be mentally ill. I'm not saying they will be meeting psychiatric diagnostic criteria, but they will be struggling. Their mental health will not be, as good as it could be. So we know that every single day, at least, you know, 1 in 4 people, so what's that, 25% people, are probably a little bit distracted. They're probably not quite on top of their game because they've got challenges. Yeah. So not only are people staying away from work, but when they come into work,
they're not as productive.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So look, tell me what it looks like when it's done well by a chief executive. And as I said, your challenge that we'll see in many complex organisations is that people don't want to say there's a problem. Whether they're experienced the problem, whether the manager has been told there's a problem, you have to have a culture that risks openness in a journey to improve things? And where, without, you know, you don't need to name names, but where have you seen it done well and how?
To be honest, I haven't seen the what I would call the identification of risk to well-being done very well anywhere across New Zealand. I think people are starting to dabble in that space. Quite a lot of people have done are doing well in terms of what I spoke about earlier, in terms of the resiliency, the toughening up. I personally don't like the language around psychological first aid, because that sounds to me like we wait for someone to, you know, to be harmed and then we'll put a band-aid on them. So there are pockets of there are organisations where they're doing some of the work that needs to be done to be really protecting people's well-being, but I don't see anyone doing all the work. And by all the work, I mean some of the work should be done, and this is what I'd be saying to a senior executive, you have to start identifying the causes. What are some of the things that are putting people's well-being at risk, and build in some of the protective factors that we know make a difference to people. So there's some work to be done in that space. And then, you know, sometimes the nature of the work, like shift work, we know that shift work has a potential to impact on people's mental health. So then we should be doing some work to be able to help people manage that shift work. So, you know, we need to be able to identify the risk. We need to be able to build people's capability in a proactive way, not wait for them to be suffering and then start doing something. But the reality is we all fall through the cracks. So we should also be having some work in place to help people restore their well-being. And then the other obligation, of course, is if someone is experiencing some level of harm, they should be able to access some level of medical or counselling support from us. So when you say what should senior leaders be doing, they should be stepping back and saying, do we have in place work that covers all those four areas, and not just providing the EAP for when people are...
Do people fear that this is going to cost more? Because we are working some of the longest hours in the OECD. We have had for the last 30 or 40 years a cost-cutting approach to improving productivity, which has done zip, frankly, to improve our overall... it's probably done something, but we've reached the limits of what we can do to improve productivity that way. So do people fear that if they start reorganising work, that perhaps recognises people need more time for the rest of their life, perhaps recognises that shift workers may need recovery time beyond someone who's not working through the circadian rhythm, you know, challenges of shift work? Do people straight away think, this is going to end up costing me more?
I think that is a real fear for many people. And I think the reframing I'd like to make is that when you do create a workplace in which people can thrive, the gains to the organisation in terms of people's, not just their productivity, but in terms of, their relationships with other people and the engagement is huge. So there will be a cost. And I know and understand that for many people that is a little scary. But if they could also actually understand that well-being is actually not just about trying to prevent people from being harmed, it's also about being very proactive and creating an environment which is not toxic, but would be, what we define as good work.
And Catherine, can
I just say that's more than just decent work? So if you look at the Human Rights Act in New Zealand, you know, enshrined in the Act is the importance of providing at least minimum standards and equal pay for equal work. I just think that's the minimum we should be striving to achieve. If we could create a culture where people could prosper, the organisation will benefit. So the thing with, you know, with the why I make this a leadership issue more than anything else is that we have to be able to take the long-term view here. There might be some short-term costs.
Well, there may be a surge in productivity as a result as well. Would you come back? Could we do a couple of sessions that almost kind of do case studies? Would you be open to doing that over the next wee while?
Oh, absolutely.
That would be
absolutely great.
Let's pick some different size workplaces and let's talk about what this could look like. I'd really love to do that with you if you'd be willing to.
I would be. And I think your point about, what you can do as a small business relative to what you can do to, the large businesses is significantly different, but the obligation is no different for a small business as a large business.
It's legal, is your point.
Yeah.
It is legal. Let's talk again, Hilary. Thank you very much, Dr.
Pleasure.
Hilary Bennett.
Thanks, Catherine.